I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about great books to read. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. If you're interested in recommendations on great reads, you are in the right place. On the book show, our regulars tell you what we're reading, and we ask you to call in about a book that you have enjoyed. The number is 203-776-9677. The easy way to remember, 203-776-WNPR. Book club members, we also love to know what you've been reading. This is how the word gets spread on very good books. 203-776-WNPR. Our regulars are here. Roxanne Cody of R.J. Julia Booksellers in Madison, Connecticut, Rose Quiello, adjunct professor at Quinnipiac University, and Lee Jacobus, who is author of Hawaiian Tales, which came out this spring in paperback. Okay, here we go. Roxanne, what do you have?
I want to mention a book called Light Between Oceans by M. Stedman, and I'm bringing it up. We might have spoken about it a year and a half or so ago, but this is out in paperback now, and I think people get interested in books sometimes only when they're in paper. This was a book that Scribner's was wildly excited about. It's set on the western coast of Australia in the 1800s. And it's about these kind of moral paths that you can take. The story in, you know, compactly is, there's a man who's the lighthouse keeper. He's alone. He wants to marry somebody. They get married. She comes from the mainland. And they're desperate to have a child, can't get pregnant. And then miraculously, a boat shows up with the grown-up having died and a baby. And the course of action that they both take from there and the unraveling of what that can cause, this is a book that you can't put down. Every one of the characters is fascinating. It gives you the great moral dilemma to talk about. Would you have done this? Would you have not done that?
So, Rose, did you read this too? And did you talk about this book? Is that what I'm remembering?
Yes, I read it. I also could not put it down. I had swollen eyes after because you really can understand each of the characters' point of view.
So, Roxanne, so it's a great summer read, would you say?
It's a fantastic summer read. It's called Light Between Oceans by M. Stedman.
Okay, great. Rob, Faith Middleton, and the gang, welcome to the book show. Go ahead, Rob.
Thank you. I'd like to recommend The Brain That Changes Itself by Norman Doidge.
Okay, Rob, what is that about? Can you explain?
Basically, it's about a field called neuroplasticity, which is basically the brain that rewires itself throughout its life. And for me, it was personally very interesting and fun to read because as a little kid, I had severe TBI and just noticing the changes in my body that have happened naturally in and of itself without even really trying. I mean, as a kid, I had pretty much zero hand-eye-foot coordination. And I'd say 5-6 years ago, I thought I could throw things up in the air, walk without looking down where I'm going and catch them. And that in and of itself was a minor miracle. But I'm also, through this book, I realized how other parts of me have changed. And it isn't just for people who've had TBI. It really, I think, goes for anyone. It's a really interesting read. Unlike a lot of books created by doctors, it's not at all hard to follow. You don't need a doc doctorate to follow this.
Oh, Rob. Rob, thank you so much. I thought I recognized your voice, and I know you've called the show before. I'm so grateful that you've called and told us about this book. You know, I'm very moved by the idea that this book has describe to you what's happening in your own brain and the possibility there. And I'm so glad you called. Thank you. Can you say the title once more?
Yes. It's The Brain That Changes Itself.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much, Rob. Appreciate it. Okay. Bye-bye. And for those who don't know, TBI, of course, refers to traumatic brain injury. Rose Cuello.
Faith, as I was leaving our book club, one of our book club members said, Rose, you must read A Constellation of Vital Phenomena by Anthony Mara. She said, it's the best book I've read in a decade, and she made me buy it. Well, as I was standing in line at the bookstore, three people came up to me while I was holding this book and told me about it. I had not heard of it. Now I find out it's won all kinds of awards.
What's it about?
The book opens in a rural village in Chechnya.
So this is a novel?
Novel. Uh-huh. A novel where an 8-year-old girl, Hava, watches as her father is being abducted out of the house by the Russian militia, and her house is set on fire. And she stands in the forest with her little blue suitcase that her father told her to pack in the event that something like this would happen. She's rescued by a neighbor who's a physician, a goofy kind of physician who becomes the moral hero of the story. And he takes her to a hospital and puts her under the care of Sonia, the only doctor who has survived in this little village caring for these tortured people. I'm only a third of the way through it. I'm told it will scar my conscience. I cannot wait to have my conscience scarred. I cannot wait to get home and continue to read this book.
And what do you mean by that it will scar your conscience?
I'm told that there, well, I'm told this. I haven't gotten there yet. That this will force me to rethink the whole idea of torture, the whole idea of war, in a way that is new and fresh. And now I'm just hooked on the language. It's called A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, first novel by Anthony Mara, M-A-R-R-A.
So I read the book in Galley, and because we picked it as a signed first edition at the bookstore, and your fascination with it continues. But I didn't find that it scarred me, to use your language, but it reminded me of what all this stuff we read in the paper, and it's ironic that it's Chechnya now with what's going on in the Ukraine and what's going, it reminds you what all this looks like on the ground, what this looks like to real people who are just collateral damage to political infighting, to war. He has done an astonishing job. And the two characters, Havar and Sonia, you know, will just stay with you. They're amazing.
Rose, is this the first novel?
Yes.
Okay.
His first novel.
How amazing. All right. We're going to come to Lee in a second. Jerry, Faith Middleton and the gang, welcome to the book show at 203-776-WNPR. Go ahead, Jerry.
I was just calling. I happened to be in a bookstore the other day.
Yeah.
I saw a book called The Trigger. And it's dealing with the assassination, the worst assassination of the 20th century, because it was Franz Ferdinand, the Archduke of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And his death had ramifications for the entire 20th century. And the book deals with the Serbian nationalists who looked as if they were terrorists to everyone else. And it set off the First World War, or the March to War, which had the greatest implications for the rest of the century. And it is fascinating.
Now, did you say this was history or novel?
This is history.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Nonfiction.
Yeah, nonfiction.
Saturday is the 100th anniversary of his assassination. And the implications of that is there's no, at the end of 4 years, there's no German Empire, no Russian Empire, no Ottoman Empire, and no German Empire. And the problems we're facing right now in Iraq, much of it goes back to what the British and French did with Syria and Iraq, or it was called Mesopotamia at the time. Hmm. 100 years ago, or 96 years ago.
Wow. So title once more.
The Trigger.
Mm.
And there's, I mean, anybody who's interested in the First War, there's tons of books coming out. The Sleepwalkers is another good book that deals with a crisis in July of 1914. Mm. There's an older book called The Lions of July.
It sounds like you're a history reader.
I have 2 degrees in history.
Yeah.
Okay. And I study a lot of the implications of that second decade of the 20th century from 1910 with the Chinese Revolution and the Mexican Revolution right on through the end of the Irish Civil War in 1920.
You know, Jerry, I'm so interested in this, of what you're saying, because I am so ignorant about this period. This is a period I know the least about, and when people start talking about World War I and how many people were killed and what went on, and I become so fascinated with how in the world did we get into that conflict, you know? So I thank you so much for letting us know about that book, letting me know about it, especially.
One other thing. More people died in the flu pandemic of 1918 and 19 than died in the First World War.
That's amazing.
Oh, yes. That was,
take care.
Okay, thank you so much, Jerry. I really, really appreciate it. Lee Jacobus, what do you have?
Well, I don't know whether I have enough ballast of humor to, even us out with all this dead seriousness of these books that you guys have been talking about. But I read, on your recommendation, Bob Mankoff's remarkable book called All But Never Is Never Good For You. He's, of course, the editor of a cartoon editor or drawing editor for The New Yorker, and he tells us about himself.
This is one of my favorite memoirs in years.
Yeah, no, to goodness.
It's a great memoir. You know, he's a Queens white guy, Queens wise guy who just does the most awful things and yet gets away with them all. He does one thing that really gets me very where I live. He never showed up to a given course in Syracuse until the final exam. And he's sitting down ready to write the final exam. The teacher comes over, the professor comes over and says, "It's who the hell are you?" he says. And Mankoff looks up at him and says, "Well, I might ask the same question of you." And thankfully, he got an F on that, the grade I would have given
right.
him, too. But you know what's wonderful about the book, apart from the fact that he shows you all these great cartoons and tells you about how he broke into the business, you know, how he started, all that kind of stuff. That's fascinating. But he also tells, for example, the story of how Jack Ziegler broke in. And Jack Ziegler, I happen to have met one time in the Creek, and also Mick Stevens. So he does some wonderful things. You just cannot help but laugh and smile and giggle through the whole book. Joanna gave this to me, and I gave her a great big kiss.
Yeah.
So it's How About Never, Bob Mankoff, a terrific book.
Right. How About Never is Never Good For You. And
I love that line.
He's also extremely interesting about how cartoons get created and what it is like to be someone not only who is a cartoonist, a great one himself, but is and wrote one of the great cartoons of all time. But
and how he picks cartoons to put in The New Yorker.
Yeah,
how
that's difficult, an education in itself.
How
too.
Difficult this is. I mean, it's just fascinating, fascinating book and tons of fun. I would put this on one of my top 10 summer reads.
Oh, yeah.
How About Definitely. Never is Never Good For You by Robert Mankoff, M-A-N-K-O-F-F. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Our number here at the studio, if you've got a book to tell us about book clubs, we want to hear from you too, 203-776-WNPR. We'll take a quick break, and then we have more great reads to tell you about, including Transatlantic by Colin McCann. Stay with us. Thank you. I'm Faith Middleton. It's great to have you listening to this fresh edition of The Book Show. Everybody's here, Lee Jacobus, Roxanne Cody, and Rose Quiello, my book buddies. And I wanted to let you know that we're going to do, in the last segment of the show, we're going to save a little bit of time to talk with an author of a book. We thought it'd be fun to toss in an author interview. We have live on the show Mike Bond, who has done a thriller called The Last Savannah. And it's set in Africa, and it is based on Mike Bond's actual life. It involves the poaching of elephants in Africa, and this is something that he was involved in. He's been connected to Africa for a long, long time, and involves he was an officer. Well, anyway, we'll tell you all about it. It's quite a story. And there is a connection between what is going on in that ivory trade and terrorism, it turns out, which I did not know about. So that's coming up on the show. Very quickly, I wanted to mention, Roxanne said an interesting thing. It is true because of the cost of books, and especially for people who like to hold books in their hands, that people wait for a paperback to come out. And so I wanted to let you know that a favorite writer, Colm McCann, has come out with a book called Transatlantic. And in hardback, this was a bestseller. And Mishko Kukatani, the New York Times reviewer, said, you know, she thought this was just an amazing book and a very moving portrait. And Colm McCann is known for this. You know, Let the Great World Spin was his book. This is a guy who takes a couple of themes and then just writes this huge kind of epic thing. He's an incredibly brave writer, a great Irish storyteller. And so he's got three things going on at the same time. And believe it or not, he weaves these together. So you're in Newfoundland, 1919, and there are these couple guys who are aviators, Jack Alcock and Arthur Brown. And they're setting off for Ireland, and they're trying to do the first nonstop flight across the Atlantic. So that's one. Then you've got the second strand. You're Dublin, 1845, 1846. And there is a Frederick Douglass, who finds out that the Irish people are sympathetic to the abolitionists. And so he heads to Ireland. And then you have New York, 1998. And we have Senator George Mitchell, who really leaves for Belfast. And he's the son of an Irish-American father, a Lebanese mother. And it's his job to go to Northern Ireland and try and make peace there. These three themes Colm McCann weaves together in this novel called Transatlantic. And Kukatani said in the New York Times, this is especially a deeply moving portrait of Lily and her descendants. And this is about hope and survival against this century and a half of Irish-American history. So he was a National Book Award winner, Colm McCann. He is something. He is really, really something. Talk about a high wire act writer. Yeah. He's one of those guys.
He's really one of the most delightful people you'd want to talk to, too. He is really something.
Just interviewed him with Michael Cunningham. And the two of them, I thought I had gone to book heaven, honestly.
Michael Cunningham.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So, okay. So there you go. So did I say Transatlantic by Colm McCann? Megan, Faith Middleton and the gang, welcome to the book show.
Hi, I'd like to recommend a novel that my book club is reading and discussing this weekend called The Roundhouse by Louise Eldridge, and it's a New York Times bestseller about a Native American family.
And have you finished it yet? Can you say a little bit more, or have you not done your homework yet? What's the story? I call this book clubitis. Go ahead.
I almost couldn't put the book down. I read it in 2 or 3 days, and we'll be discussing it this weekend. It's told from the perspective of a 13-year-old boy who lives on a Native American reservation in South Dakota when, in the very first chapter, a very tragic assault occurs against his mother, and it looks from his perspective, the family coping with this tragedy, and also with the logistics of legislation surrounding the reservation and how justice will be served to this family.
Ah, this sounds good. And is it told, is he the narrator, the boy?
Yes. Louise Eldridge is actually a female author, and I thought she did a wonderful job writing from the perspective of a 13-year-old boy.
Ah, Megan. So, Megan, you've anticipated my comment or my question for you, because this, for me as a reader, this is one of the great challenges when someone is, an author is trying to channel a young person. You know, that can be, to get that voice exactly right and have it be believable is, I mean, this is what authors do all the time, of course, and you either believe them or you don't, and to not believe them is to have a kind of ruined book experience in your hands. But there's something extra high wire for me about channeling a child in a story. So I'm so glad to hear that, Megan. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for a fantastic show.
Oh, thank you. And call us regularly about what your book show's reading. We love that.
Sounds good.
Thanks,
have a great
Megan.
Day.
Okay, you're one of our book show correspondents, okay? Okay, thanks. Roxanne.
So this is changing the order of what I was going to mention, but talking about using a narrator that's a younger voice, a book that I read not that long ago was Jeanette Walls' A Silver Star. So Jeanette Walls wrote Glass Castle. This is a fiction book. And the narrator is a 12-year-old girl. So maybe a 12-year-old girl like her. But this little girl reminded me of sort of a rascal scout, you know, from To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. And so she narrates what it's like to grow up in a chaotic house with a kind of unreliable mother, where they're kind of the grown-ups, but they don't really realize they're the grown-ups, and they're trying to figure it out. I read this book. I was mesmerized by the family dynamics, by the narration, and it was really funny. I wrote an email about it, and I said, I really love it, and if enough of you are interested, maybe we could get Jeanette Walls. And I got 325 letters inside of a week because they were fans of Jeanette Walls. So it's called The Silver Star, also a great summer read. Fantastic.
The Silver Star.
Yeah.
And this is an adult novel.
It's a YA. It's technically adult, but I would also say it's young adult.
Great.
Yeah,
okay.
I loved
it. The Silver Star.
I just, Jeanette Walls. And very hopeful. Very much. You know how I don't generally like hopeful, happy books. But it, you were renewed in your belief about resiliency of kids.
Okay, so let's pause for a minute, because that's such an interesting thing for you to say. I don't think I would ever describe you that way, Roxanne. I know you are a rigorous reader and can read themes that we would say are challenging, tough subjects. You know, you're a student of the Holocaust, and you know, so obviously that's true. But I don't think I'd cross over and say you don't like hopeful books or happy books. And do you really see yourself that way?
Well, I'm often, when I give speeches, sometimes people say, Rox, do you have any happy books? And I brought some happy books today because it's summer. But what I would say is books that have an arc, that have a kind of hopefulness all along, like a happy quality, that doesn't attract me. I don't feel like there's enough for me to sort of get a grip on. And it's different between liking hopeful books. I like books about resilient people. I like understanding how people deal with very difficult situations. But I would say a lot of happy books don't appeal to me.
Mm-hmm. And Rose, what about you?
Well, I think there's a distinction between happy books and hopeful books, a real distinction, because I don't like happy books either. Hmm.
Well, now, what do you mean when you say, what is a happy book to you?
Let me think. Maybe a typical romance story with a they lived happily ever after ending. My students always say, why are all the books we read so sad? And I say, because writers write out of pain. They don't usually write out of joy. Now, that might or might not be true, but that's what I tell them. And I find that they're always complaining that the books I choose are sad books. But there's always that quality of forgiveness and hopefulness.
And also seriousness. Don't forget seriousness. Because I got for 41 years, I got the same complaint. You know, why are these books all like tragedies in a sense? Well, it's partly because you're looking for a dimension of seriousness. Mm-hmm. The question of whether a happy book is well worth reading or not, it really depends upon how authentic its portrayal of life is. And that's the difficult. You're talking about books that are sentimental for reasons that you don't approve because you see them as trivial. If you see something that is serious and is authentic and realistic to life, hopeful or not, they're going to be good books.
So, Lee, that's a really good point because I was going to embellish my comment about happy books, and you hit on it exactly. What I don't like is a book where things end up in a unequivocal kind of happiness that doesn't feel realistic to me.
Yeah.
In other words, you can have happy moments. Mm-hmm. You can have an element of your life that feels satisfied and happy, but there's a realization about the complexity of what things look like. So I think Lee's point is exactly right because I am a happy person. So that's where there's a funny – I mean, I always look at the bright side of things, as you well know, Faith. So what I don't like is when I think it's – happy in a sentimental, unrealistic way. That's a great way of putting it.
And you can also have a happy ending and a good book as long as the characters have paid their dues along
the way.
Because that's what you look for, is someone who lived a serious life and tried to figure things out and maybe by sheer luck or by sheer design found a way to make the life, the ending a happy ending. That can happen.
So here's a question that I'm going to toss out to all of you for just a minute, and then we're going to go back to calls and keep going with our reads. But I get a comment from people, and I certainly identify with this comment, where people say, you know, I want to find more books where things sometimes work out for people.
Mm-hmm.
And so this isn't about sentimentality. It isn't about stage managing characters and plots so that they're not authentic. But it does require, I think, imagining as a writer that things working out for people, possibility, has as much value in our dramatic story of human beings as things that don't work out. So we know in the theater and in novels too that it's easy to tell a story around tension. It's harder to tell a story in which things work out for people. You know, often we call them comedies, you know, although ironically, you know, some of our great comedies have tremendous tragedy in them. This is a very complex story, and I feel as if we've gotten to the point where it is somehow considered not smart to ask this question about, the novel. Where are the people for whom things work out, and why is that less intelligent? Why is goodness less smart? Why did was it Tolstoy who said, you know, all happy families are – are the same, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's a dismissive comment in a lot of ways. I understand what he's saying about drama.
Well,
anyway, a very big subject, and maybe we should do a call-in show on this.
Here's what you're saying reminds me of, which I am very sympathetic to. Jennifer Weiner, who wrote Good and Bad and is a, you know, wildly successful writer, has written in The New Yorker and lots of places about why is it that stories about women and their domestic lives or books by women are somehow less. And I think that's a sister to your comment about what about happy books where things work out, that why is it that those are considered lesser books? And so, you know, to me, it's about what are you reading for at that moment? And so sometimes I'm reading to learn. Sometimes I'm learning. I'm reading to be entertained. Sometimes I'm reading to learn to live in another person's shoes, like learn about another culture, place, or whatever. But I do think your comment is fair. And in anticipation of that, I brought a perfect example of a happy book that was fun, where things work out perfectly.
Okay. Well, we'll hear about that in just a second. Susan, Faith Middleton and the gang, welcome to the book show. Go ahead, Susan.
Oh, thanks. I wish I had come on after the historian, but now is just as good as ever while you're considering books with happy endings. I am a historian, and I usually do read nonfiction because I find it much more compelling than dramas written about it. But I do want to talk about a happy book because I want to bring back an author from the early 20s called Robert Benchley, B-E-N-C-H-L-E-Y, who wrote probably more than 40 books, short stories. His son did, Nathaniel did The Russians Are Coming, and his grandson did Jaws. They're all dead. But Robert, his short stories are as pertinent today as when they were written between the 20s and the 40s, whether it's politics or normal social conventions or whatever. He's hysterical. So that's the one person that I wanted to mention.
Great,
with Robert
Susan.
Benchley.
Thank you very much for
I
that.
Have another book that I would like to throw out, and that is a book by Michael Wex called Born to Kvetch. And it is the history of Yiddish done in a very tongue-in-cheek manner.
Born to Kvetch. Okay, excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, but I do want to say something about the history of these situations that are sometimes so much more dramatic than what is written about them. And as Rox knows, I have a rare bookshop in Clinton, which is mostly reference and research, but I do have fiction, and I do love fiction. But I will say that Benchley, for a beach read, five pages, you can't beat them.
Thank you, Susan.
And
thank you
for
your
being there. And hi, Rox.
You're welcome.
Hi.
So, Susan, and thank you. We're going to take a quick break, and you know, that's why I was trying to just speed along a little bit. And I appreciate your patience, Susan. Off we go on our break, and then when you come back, we're going to be talking in that segment, a little later in the segment, about The Last Savannah, a thriller by Mike Bond, and this book, What Makes You Grateful? Voices from Around the World. Talk about a hopeful story. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening to this fresh edition of The Book Show. If you'd like to tweet us, it's Faith WNPR. On Facebook, search The Faith Middleton Show. Special thanks to our producers, Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol, and to Marion Roy, who is here helping us on The Book Show and works on the Food Schmooze, too. And you could go online to see the list of books from all of us at WNPR.org. Search programs for The Faith Middleton Show. Very quickly, wanted to mention a couple of books to you. One is, we told you we're going to get to The Last Savannah for the author interview in just a second. Anne Kubitsky has done a book called What Makes You Grateful? And these are voices from around the world, because Anne, a number of years ago, has, full disclosure, I have an endorsement on this book because I liked her project very much. And, you know, sent out postcards and said, what are you grateful? Blank postcards, and invited people, you know, write on this postcard and send it back to me. What are you grateful for? And people immediately started sending them from all over the country and then all over the world. And this book is that. And this is what I am talking about a book that happy is not a word that I would use for any of these books. but books that sort of reflect the range of human experience include the possibility that things work out for people. In this book, you see postcards from people who've been through really tough stuff, and that would include our editor here, Anne Kubitsky, and yet they. This really is a demonstration of a certain kind of resilience in people, or at the very least, a moment. You know, talking about mindfulness, people pausing for a moment to say, "Yes, for this, I am grateful." It's terrific. So it's "What Makes You Grateful: Voices from Around the World" by Anne Kubitsky, and it is out in paperback, and it's published by Globe Pequot Press.
Yes, I've seen that book, too, and I've talked with her. She's terrific.
Great. Very quickly, she's been on the show, too. So very quickly, this is kind of a wild recommendation from me. Well, not wild if you know me, but there is a woman who was an executive in the beauty industry, and Andrea Robinson, and she was president of Tom Ford Beauty, Ralph Lauren Fragrances. She was the chief marketing officer for Estee Lauder, and she was the beauty editor at Vogue. She knows what she's talking about. She has done a book that is, to me, so fascinating. It is called Toss the Gloss. And this is aimed technically at women 50 and over. However, I think it applies to a woman of any age who has any interest in beauty products. And it just so happens that I do. And she is so smart. She knows exactly what all the tricks are in the beauty industry with all the makeups, what they do, what works, what doesn't work, what is nonsense, what really will bring out highlights here, there, and everywhere on your face without spending a fortune, what products are worth it, what products are... It is the best thing that I have read on this subject maybe ever. She tells the truth. She'll say, "I know how this works. I was in the industry. Do you know that this, and this? See these 20 things from these 20 different makers? Guess what? They're all the same. The same company owns them." And this one is marketed as it's good for this and this and this. It is fantastic, this book. She is a very good writer. And I'm telling you, it is one of the best books. I'm so excited about it. Called Toss the Gloss by Andrea Q. Robinson. Talk about a public service in so many ways. Okay. I highly recommend that. Maggie Shipstead has a book out called Astonish Me. And she had her first novel, Seating Arrangements. It won the Comedy of Manners. It won the Dylan Thomas Prize. And this is set in the ballet world, and it's political. And it came out in April. And I think it is just out in paperback, if I'm not mistaken. I may be wrong about that. But in any case, Maggie Shipstead, Astonish Me. It's the story of someone who's in the ballet world and leaves it, gets married, has a child. And what does the child want to do? This boy suddenly becomes interested in the ballet world, and it takes her back into this political hotbed of things. So really, she's a very good writer. Maggie Shipstead, Astonish Me. Okay, let's turn now. Everybody gets to very quickly name one book, and then I'm going to Mike Bond about his story. Name one book. What is the great book you love? It's a great beach read, and things work out for people, right?
It's called The Rosie Project.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's by Graham Simsion, Simsion. He's a man who has Asperger-ish qualities, and he goes about finding a wife in a very pragmatic way.
Yeah,
we've
talked
delightful.
About this on the show. Okay.
Just delightful.
Okay. Rose, quick mention?
Anything by Alice McDermott, who has Ordinary Women for Characters. You think her writing is ordinary, and like her characters, you look more closely, and they are extraordinary.
Yeah, great. Lee, a quick mention?
Well, the New York Times has a big thing today on James Lee Burke, who's one of the greatest of our mystery writers. I want to recommend a book I recently read called Pegasus Descending, which is about Dave Robichaud, who has to fight back after having a drunken mistake and becoming an alcoholic. He becomes converted, and he solves a big problem. It's a great book, Pegasus Descending. He's a magnificent writer. It's Mysteries of Louisiana Parishes. And James Lee Burke.
James Lee Burke, right, in the New York Times today. Okay, we have with us the author of The Last Savannah in paperback, and set in Africa. It is a thriller, and it is the author is Mike Bond, who's on the phone with us for a live interview. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the book show.
Well, thank you very much, Faith. I'm very happy to be here.
It's a pleasure. So, Mike, this is, in your story, we have ivory poachers in Africa. And this is about their cunning, their ability to gun down the last elephants in Africa. And in your story, there's an SAS officer, a former SAS officer, and his name is Ian McAdam. And he leads this commando squad against these poachers. And he's trying to get them, and there's a woman involved, there's archaeology. Now, this is based on parts of your life, isn't it?
Yeah, this is based on my own experiences in East Africa, hunting elephant poachers with the Kenyan Rangers. And but it also it's not only a thriller in that sense, Faith. It's also a if you wish, it's a farewell to Africa. It's a memoir of the magnificence of this place, which is now being lost at a very fast rate. And it's also a love story because the woman involved is an archaeologist and who is working on the area of archaeology that has brought us so many amazing finds about our own background, our own ancestors. And it's a woman, and she is kidnapped, and this is a woman that he had once loved and bitterly lost. So it's an attempt to explain Africa, to dig into Africa, to tell the reader what it's like to be on the ground with a gun facing elephant poachers who are shooting back.
It's also about the beauty of Africa and the humanity of Africa's people.
Oh, definitely. Africa is so stunningly beautiful. When you go there, I went there for the first time at age 19 and have been many times since. And when you go there for any length of time and you get out of the tourist circuit and you just to be in the savannah, which, by the way, the savannah is when you ask people all over the world to describe the ultimately beautiful place and what it would look like, they end up describing the savannah because it's in our collective memory as where we came from. And when we came down out of the trees and tried living on the ground, and it's going fast. Not only are we losing the elephants, but we're losing the lions and the leopards and the ass and the cheetahs and all kinds of other animals as well.
Mike, but, can you, as you do in your story, can you make, and this is real life we're talking about, the connection between the ivory poaching and terrorism?
Oh, it's a very close connection, which I bring out in the book. Most of the modern Islamic terrorism, all terrorism pretty much in Africa now is Islamic-based, whether you're talking about Boko Haram or any of the other Al-Shabaab or any of the other insane groups that wander the area of North Africa killing people. The connection is that a lot of their funding is through elephant poaching. They go and kill a bunch of elephants. They take the tusks, throw them in the back of a Toyota pickup truck, drive to the nearest place where they can be put into a container. The container ends up in Mombasa or some other coast city and is shipped straight to Japan, where it's worth $1,000 a pound. And it's the price of ivory has gone up 50 times in the last 10 years in China. And that's where it's all going. It's a huge vacuum sucking the last elephants out of Africa to the trinket stores of Beijing and Shanghai.
Now, is this still a source of funding now that these terrorist organizations, for lack of a better word, are finding out how lucrative kidnapping can be? Are they still engaging in this kind of poaching? Or are they switching over
absolutely
to humans?
The major courses, the major sources of funding for the terrorist organizations, not only in Africa, but also some of the, like the Islamic Army of the Levant in Iraq. The major source of all of that funding, really, when you get down to it, is every time we stop off at the gas station and fill our tank. And because with Saudi Arabia remains one of the major providers of U.S. crude or finished products, and most of that money ends up in southern Saudi and the Wahhabis, which is an extremely fanatic. It's about 100. It's a cult or a group of about 100 million people in Saudi who are the major funders of all of these insane groups, and were in the past, as we all know, a major funder of Al Qaeda, and did most of the funding that led to 9/11. These are all people living in, usually in Saudi Arabia, particularly in South Saudi Arabia. So that's the number one cause of funding for all this terrorism.
Mike Bond is on the line, and this is a live author interview. And the book is called, that he has done, the thriller is called The Last Savannah, based on his own experiences hunting with a police organization, the poachers in Africa. And so he's used it as a basis for this story. Mike, how are the local people in these communities involved? How do they get pulled into the system? Are they upset about the poaching, or are they pulled into it for the money?
Most of them are very upset because the poaching is destroying the economic fabric of all of these countries, whether you're talking Tanzania, Kenya, whatever. And so most of the local villages depend to a very large degree on tourism, and tourism is getting hammered by the elephant poaching because there's no more elephants left, number one. And number two, the overall, situation of violence and danger. I mean, when I was young in East Africa, we would see a herd of elephants 3 miles wide and 10 miles long headed down from Marsabit. In central North Kenya to Tsavo in the south. It was part of an annual migration. There's that, it doesn't exist anymore. There used to be 10 million elephants when I was young, and now there's barely 400,000. It's for real, and it's extremely serious. But the book again is about love lost and love refound, and what will a man do to protect the woman he loves and to save the woman he loves who is in great danger?
Well, novelists, you know, a lot of research gets done. Characters come to you, and a lot of research then gets done about the setting they're in. And and so I see, you know, how what a good, you know, story this is, and it's real for your characters. I wonder, Mike, how is it that you have stayed safe in, I mean, the territory we are talking about is so huge. I don't think we can quite conceive of how large Africa is. Mm-hmm. You know, we're dropping the bucket compared to Africa. But still, as vast as it is, and there are many safe places, quickly in this last minute, how do you stay safe?
But you have to be very lucky. I got shot at so many times, and most of my books had come from being shot at or otherwise terrified or semi-blown up. So you just, when you're moving in on poachers, they know you're coming, they're better armed than you are, and you have to be very, and you have no backup. It's not like the U.S. Army where you can call in choppers and all kinds of other stuff. You're out there on your own, and a bullet moves very fast.
You see why this man writes thrillers with an authenticity, huh? Thank you so much, Mike.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and it's great listening to the show, and I do appreciate it, Faith, and I send my best out to all the listeners everywhere.
Thank you, and to you, too. Thank you for your work. The Last Savannah, a thriller by Mike Bond. As always, this show is about the richness of life. You can find the books, people, the list of books, great recipes, value wines we feature right now at WNPR.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.